My name is Andy. I help people and organizations connect to purpose and make a difference in the world. In these wild and uncertain times, this podcast is an invitation towards better futures, exploring the mystery, beauty, and complexity of life through conversations with an array of incredible people, all of them working at the edge of what's possible for humanity. This is a place for big dreams, bold creativity, and fierce hope. Welcome to the Wonder Dome. If you're inspired by this conversation and you'd like to see it reach more people, you can help by sharing it with friends and colleagues, subscribing, giving us a 5-star rating, and best of all, leaving a glowing review. If you'd like to go even further, consider becoming a member of my small but mighty community of monthly supporters. You'll help me keep the lights on and provide funding to a wide range of charitable causes. You can learn more at thewonderdomepodcast.com.
My guest today is Bonita Roy. Bonnie is an author, a teacher, and an insight guide who helps individuals and groups break away from limiting patterns of thought. She is an award-winning teacher, has founded multiple groups, organizations, platforms for the spread of ideas that can actually change how we relate to reality. She helps people mature into their full potential and is a wonderfully vibrant, creative, and simultaneously down-to-earth human being who can work across many levels of abstraction and many levels of relation without losing touch with what really matters, which is, who are we and how do we want to be in the world? How do we want to be with ourselves and with each other? What are we going to do with this wisdom? How are we actually going to live into this wisdom once we begin to access it? So I started our conversation with a question that I knew if anyone of my guests so far would be keen to jam on, it would be Bonnie. And the question was simply, what are we? What are we actually? What is a human being? What is it to be human? We start beautifully with what Bonnie calls coming more fully into contact and awareness with our animal body. That whatever we are is inclusive of and lives within and moves through reality as a real live living creature, just like all the other real live living creatures around us, next to us, relating to us, whether we're aware of them or not. And one of the ways that she helps people come into their animal body is by bringing them out to her horse ranch in Connecticut and helping them experience the way in which another real living creature in its animal body can sense and feel and respond to us without words, without language, simply through gesture and energy and embodied communication. So the conversation builds from there into the layers of awareness and consciousness that make us not a horse. Even though we both, just like every other animal, have an animal body, there's also something about our consciousness that is, at least by degree, if not by distinction, different. And we could, if you want to, if you see me at a coffee shop someday, we can get into a debate by what I mean by that. But basically, there is something that is uniquely human. We are not just another primate, although we are an ape. At least that's my worldview. I know that not everyone agrees with that. We have something else, deeper, wider, higher, lower, that is ours, and this conversation explores that. What is it to be human? So, let's get settled in and hear what Bonnie has for us. Here we go. Hi, Bonnie. Welcome. Welcome to the Wonder Dome.
Hi there. We finally made it.
Goodness. I'm really glad we did. I've been looking forward to this for a while. I know that you're like, we're having kind of a weird springish day in February, and there's a bit of the like tease and a bit of the like, spring is here. Oh, wait, no, we might have a few more months of this. So just
Yeah.
kind of let, but I'm liking the brightness and the sunshine that's coming in through. It's good to be in that energy, even if it's a little bit premature.
Yeah, so the outside is calling.
Yeah.
But then there's a voice that's saying patience. There's a lot of winter left. And doesn't work for the birds. The birds are all singing. They sound like it's spring. They're singing their spring songs and
Yeah.
yeah, so there's just this confluence of, yeah, kind of like when a pond turns over, the waveforms of the climate of the seasons are starting to cuddle and they'll be turned over soon. Yeah.
I love that
So, yeah.
image. Thank you for that. Yeah. I want to start with a question that is maybe in a way a bit playful and a bit ridiculous to ask, but it feels like my sense is that it will send us off into interesting places. And the question is this, Bonnie, what are we? What is a human being? What are you? What am I? Like, what are we?
So there's a couple of ways to answer that. There's like I do a lot of metaphysics. I'm not going to start with the metaphysics, but I'm just noticing that, oh, here's an invitation, but the metaphysics is there to answer the question in the way you asked it, like feeling into that question. So first I want to say, if I have to be honest, I think I'm a mystery to myself. People are mysteries to me. So
Yeah.
I don't know what people are. If I'm really honest with take that excursion, something I've thought a lot about, then that's kind of the real truth.
Don't worry about the phone. If you need to get it, we can
Yeah.
pause or we can just let it ring. It's no
Yeah, just
problem.
let it ring.
Okay.
Yeah, so ultimately, I think we're mysteries to ourselves, and where we are always engaging the mysterious other. And to me, this is extremely exciting and inviting. It creates a sense of ongoing curiosity. Like, basically, life is for me just ongoing curiosity, interrupted by an attempt to create something that articulates some kind of guess of maybe what life is and what people are. So having said that, now I can go ahead
Well, maybe,
and
yeah, let's
guess.
hear the guess. Yeah.
So
And already lots of it's coming up. So this is wonderful. Yeah. Take us
we can
further.
have a conversation.
Yeah.
I like to start by answering this question by looking at what we might say is our primordial nature, which is, I would say, is our animal nature. You can go further down in my metaphysics. I do go further down, but it gets very theoretical. And since I've worked my whole life with plants and animals, and I do these workshops with horses, which is basically noticing how much they resonate with you, but but they only can meet you at their animal nature because they don't have higher linguistic strategies and stuff like that. They don't have narratives. So that's what I'm talking about, that like there's something fundamental of the animal of our animal nature, and then there's something else, right? So this is not to say that we understand everything else in the animal realm. There could be properties or subjective characteristics of animals that we don't have any way to really enter into that reality except through science or something. But we know that
There's a certain place, I know that there's a certain place in my experience as a human that is not accessible at the same level with the animals. So I always, so that's how I start. Maybe I'll just start there and then.
Could I interject for a moment and say, could you share a bit more about why you work with horses? What's powerful about that and what that does for people, or what that illuminates for people who might not have had that awareness until they spend time with you and with the horses?
I think that most of what people suffer from are thoughts and narratives about themselves, and they go on and on and justify, they try to justify their lives, they try to justify their experiences, they're in self-reflective loops of narrative. And in that process, they live in a simulated world, and their body and their natural state becomes distorted. It would be okay, it wouldn't be as sad if that was just built on a healthy and calm and comfortable body mind, but more and more people live in, I think, this kind of simulated jungle, which is extremely uncomfortable. It distorts their personality and their character and their possibility. So the first thing is for them to access their animal nature, to understand what, you know, when I say human nature, that word nature for me is the same as when I point out at the birds and say nature.
Mm.
But to me, that's level one. But most people, when they say human nature, they're talking about personality or psychology or something like that. So with the horses draw out, or especially, well, this is complex because many people just abuse their horses because they can't understand how much resonance there is in the natural world with bodies in space. I call it bodies in space.
Mm.
And so we're trying to integrate the body back into the human experience because it's essential to creativity and happiness. And it determines the kind of person you are, whether you are more likely to do malevolent or beneficent actions. So so that's why I think it's important to start there. Many people are in a constant state of pain, both physical pain, psychological pain. You can't think well if you can't move your body well. If you don't have any embodied skills, you know, this is why, like in Eastern cultures, they practice archery and these kind of embodied wisdom practices, because that actually trains the mind. So so that's how we use horses or gardening or any other kind of movement activity.
Is there a story that comes to mind of a moment, maybe with you and with a horse, or with one of your retreat participants, like where that resonance you point to was made clear and available to awareness, and what happened when that resonance was made clear? Like what do people learn as they start to get in more into their bodies and resonate with this other living animal that is like them in many ways, despite the big differences too?
Well, one example is I tried to keep everything extremely simple, and this alone is very hard for people. So
it's hard to stay simple.
Yes, they'll come into a relation, you know, they come into the paddock area and they mingle around and they get the sense that a horse picks them. It's very obvious. So that's at first very interesting to them. You know, why is this one following me around? I want to make friends with that one, but this one's following me around. So this notion, I call it bodies in space. Bodies distort space, and some are push-pull. You know, you just understand that there's already a lot going on that you don't understand. Some people, will say, no one's picking me. And everyone will say, what do you mean? You can't see that horse has been following you around like a puppy dog. So then they're aware that they're totally not aware. They're not perceptive. They're not using their perceptions. And so basically the work is trying to get you to use your perceptions, and my horses aren't classically trained, so they are a little dangerous. So that also, and they're big, so that also creates more probability that people will be not in their heads, but in the external world, in their world of perception. So one thing that might happen is, and bring the person in the we work in an intimate space in the barn, and there's usually people sitting in the audience, and I'll give them a little stick and I'll say, the stick is not, I'll show them the horse eats the stick. They're not afraid of the stick, but the stick is so the people can be more congruent in their own action. And I will show them, I'll face their horse and I'll say, okay, we're going to ask this horse to move its right foot back 3 times. Okay. And that's all we're going to do. And then I'll show them. And of course, as soon as I get it, and I'll give them some information, like, what you're not going to do is stop when you get one. If he moves his foot back once, you're not going to stop, because we're asking him to do it 3 times. And if he does it once, and then you start again, it's like you're nagging him. So you have to make sure that that's your goal. Set that as your goal. That foot has to move back 3 times.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So then I show them, get yourself oriented in front of the horse. And all you have to do is make sure that the way you're moving, look at the foot and move the stick like this toward the foot. It's very simple. So they see me do it. I hardly even have to move the stick. My body is so congruent. My intention, they can feel it. They'll move without me using the stick. Okay. And then I'll tell them, if the horse doesn't move, you can even take that stick and fuss with its ankle, so it's annoying, just to get it started. Because likely you're not going to have that much intention at first.
Yeah.
So they start. And they go like this, and the horse actually stands more still. Like, they take this thing like, I am not moving at all. And then they'll hit the ankle, because I told them they could. And the horse, it doesn't hurt them. They just like, what is going on? This is like the most stupid thing in the world. And so they realize that, and it's different for different people. They realize that they are not, their whole body mind is not composed to ask this question. So they may be afraid of asking. Some people cry when they hold the stick because they think it's abusive. Some people have that much trauma in them. Some people, I'll say, okay, what are you trying to do, after they're frustrated? And they'll say, well, I'm getting that. I want to get him to know that I want him to move his foot. And I'm like, that's too complex. You're not talking to the horse's mind. So it gets, so the whole process to where they get very simple, very congruent, they understand how to place their intention where the intention wants to go. And then it's like magic. I mean, I can move the horse just with changing slight gestures and changing my intention. You can catch horses that run away that way. There's all kinds of things you can do. And it looks like magic, but it's not magic. It has to do with our basal cognition as embodied animals. And people are light years away from understanding how to use their body as a fundamental sensory motor organ.
You know, this, I was just wrapping up with one of my clients yesterday, and they were asking me, like, one of the things we were working on was helping them feel more, have more access to feeling, because they were such a strong thinking energy that when, for instance, someone would hug them, they would start getting narratives like, am I, they seem to, should I be doing this a certain way? Am I feeling enough emotion right now? What, like they would really get into this thinking pattern. And long story short, like the work we landed in as a reminder is your body, all of your thoughts are part of your body, or exist, like they are only possible because your body is there in the very spot it's in. So if I were in your shoes, I would just notice that I'm thinking a lot and see if I can relax that and just notice how does it feel to have their arms around me? How do my feet feel on the ground? How does it, can I notice my heart beating? Can I just that practice will lead to more feeling, not less. And I'm noticing some kind of harmony with what you're saying, like that there's just this way in which our consciousness and our cognition and our emotion all start with our ability to be in our bodies simply and without analysis.
It's so powerful. And two things come to mind. I was working with this one woman, and they're all wonderful people. And she was very in her head. I told her, I want all your attention in your feet. So she's in this small enclosed place with a horse. And I said, and all I want you to do is feel where your feet want to go. And I said, and you'll feel it like, for some reason, this foot wants to go there. And for some reason, and that's how we start, she started. And once she got into that level of simplicity, those of us watching saw this extremely interesting dance where the horse would come behind her and kind of cup her and then stand with her and be relaxed. And all this kind of very sensual movement started to self-organize. This from and one of the things when I see this, I say to people, is that most people, even if they have a lot of social interactions, deep down inside they're lonely. And I say the whole world wants to fall into relationship with bodies this way. Bodies want to be in relationship with other bodies this way. But all this other activity is actually pushing people away. Even the social conventions that we have when we meet people is primarily social anxiety, which separates. So, when I really look at it, I used to really despair. There's a lot of work to do, but I worked with this young man once who came all the way over from Germany. He had alexithymia, something like that. And apparently it's a condition where you can't feel your feelings. He'd been diagnosed with it. So he came here, which surprised me because I was not really qualified to address these kind of issues, but he worked with a group. And the group I had, everybody had a horse. And what you had to do is walk your horse across a tarp that when you went across it was it would move around and make noises. And horses get excited, and then the people get excited, which means then the horses get more excited. And it's like biofeedback to try to be. And every single one of the people, there was maybe six people in this group workshop. They could not get their horse across, but he got his horse across, and she was a young filly who's not calm. I mean, she's not like, oh yeah, of course he picked the horse that would walk across. So I asked him, how did you do that? And he said, I don't know how I did it. And he said, I just went slow. I noticed his hand was very, very sensitive to, like he didn't pull on her. He was very, the rope in his hand was very sensitive. And when he felt like he should move, he moved. So I was very interested because I said to him, well, your body acts like a very powerful feeler. Like his feelings were all there. And it turned out he thought he couldn't feel his feelings because he didn't know that the words that we use for feelings were supposed to point to something in his body. He was looking for symbolic references. That's how he grew up. He was so, and I think on the 10th day he was staying in the studio, I went up there and I opened the door and he came running down the hall and he was crying. He was on the verge of having a panic attack. And he laid down and he said, "What is this?" And I, "What is this?" I said, "These are feelings." And I said, "Look, I know you think you have to figure out why you're so upset." And I'm like, you're not crying, crazy crying because something went wrong. It's just, it's all been bottled up. So don't make more meaning to it than it is, you know? And when I tell this story, a lot of young men say, "You just told the story of my whole life. I didn't know that the words," like young people have a language instinct and you can, like autistic, profoundly autistic people, you know, Templeton Grandlin said this, is you learn what is the socially accepted behavior that makes it work, but you can't, doesn't really reflect as in your interior, you know? And I hear a lot of people say, "Yeah, it took me a long time to realize that it was like they were running around like large language modules, knowing how to, okay, here's this word bubbles coming, so I have to say sad, and this is when I say this word." And they never understood that the words were supposed to point to something happening in your body.
Oh, wow. I love both of those stories. Thanks, Bonnie. Brings up a lot for me. But maybe a part of me is tempted to just keep sort of cooking here in the sort of feeling embodied space, but I feel like we've established enough of a ground to stand on to maybe start to play with, okay, if that's true, that we all have an animal embodied nature, much as, you know, we could go on a diatribe around how certain religious and cultural and economic systems don't want us to have that nature or don't value that nature or fill in the blank, we have it. And when we start to contact it without the interference of, or without the laying upon of narrative and story and thought patterns, really magical stuff that looks magical can start to happen.
Right.
Okay. So if this is like a reality that more of a, that we all have access to, even someone who's been told they don't have any feelings, exactly, or they don't know how to feel feelings.
It's always operating.
I'm kind of, just as an aside, I for some reason thought of Oliver Sacks' work and like how if there's like a split in the brain hemispheres or the brain is damaged, like there's something that happens where a person, they can't like, they're like, "Oh no," like phantom limb syndrome, for instance, like, "Yeah, and I still have an arm there."
Yeah.
Like I can feel it. There's some, all of these oddities that happen if our bodies get disrupted in some way, but we, so consciousness is trying to like work that. But if that's our foundation, then what's there that is potentially not there or there in a different way in a horse versus a human? Like, what is it then, your sense of, and this is maybe now the real invitation into the metaphysics, what's there that is human if we're just an animal like the horse?
So let's build up on this. So you have some lower animals that can sense their environment and they have a feedback system which will positively or negatively valence it. So they get to something too hot, then they move the other way. They get to something too cold, then they move the other way. So this is a very fundamental consciousness or interior. So that's the sensory, that's the sentient only animal. And then above that you have let me just get my thing here because so I do it in the right order. So that's just sentience. There's this sense of positive and negatively valencing immediate experience, right? Then you have what I would call cognition these words are just placeholders. People use that word and define it in different ways. But when I go from sentience to cognition, you positively and negatively valence immediate experience, but you also have predicated environments. What do I mean that? You also are saying, oh, it's possible for me to move over there, but there's no positive or negative valence to it, but there's an attractor. So you start to get a curious, you start to have, I call it cognition, because Michael Levin said cognition is the ability to solve problems by different means. And without this open predicating possibility in another direction,
yeah, you're not there yet, but you're aware that you could be there.
Right. And then when you enter it, you positively and negatively balance it. Whereas the simpler form is just positively and negatively responding in the immediate thing. Okay. So cognition has that. You have a predicated environment. And then when you have mind, you have predictive processing. And it's a little different than how Friston describes it. But once you have mind, you have the ability to simulate your environments. Now, many animals have the ability to simulate their environments. So you take a New Caledonian crow and you give them a puzzle that has multiple steps and you let them loose. The first three steps he'll have figured out because he just he simulates it in his mind and knows how to do it. Or what do I mean by simulated environment? If you and I were plumbers and we were going to put plumbing in this basement, we would say, well, let's put this major main line there. We'll put a four-way thing here. And you and I are entering the same simulation. So I'm not using this in a bad way. So now once you can simulate your environment, you are using that to predict that I'm going to solve these problems, which is different than just going into a predicated environment.
Right.
Okay.
Right.
Now, the interesting thing is, so not only can animals simulate environments, they can simulate. So the crow can see this environment and simulate it, but animals can also simulate novel environments. So they know this from rats. So this one guy he was working with rats, and instead of he had electrodes in the rats' brains, but instead of watching blips on a screen, he was making the electrical signals make certain sounds because he could discern finer features than if he just watched blips on the screen. And he got so good. He knew, like, if a rat was running maze A, it sounded like a certain song to him. And if the rat was running maze B, he could recognize the song instead of the patterns. And one night, this very famous story, it's true. So one night he was working late at night. And the rats were sleeping and he forgot to turn off the equipment. And he heard a rat sing a new song, and it was part of A and part of B. So they were simulating novel environments, which makes sense because and this has also solved the problem why rats learn so fast, because the scientist is then going and he's taking part of maze A and part of maze B. And he's like, I'm going to fool him. And the rat learns faster because he'd gone through it in his dreams. Okay. In this certain type of REM sleep. Okay. So that's what I would call mind. And we can't say this is human, just human yet, because the animals can do it.
Yeah.
And so then we
Could
get
I
to
pause real quick. Yeah. Do you remember the name of that researcher or research? And if not, we'll try and find it to include in the show notes.
But yeah, that's we'll put it in the show notes. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. Great. Okay.
Okay. And then we have humans, which have all of that, and they can simulate their self. As far as we know, this doesn't happen in the animal world. We have theory of mind in the animal world, but that's just recognizing yourself. And so you have this reflexivity. You can put yourself as a little avatar in your mind and You know, have fantasies and dreams and pretend all kinds of things. You can play out novel realities for yourself. This happens to be both a wonderful benefit and a horrible curse.
Yeah, say more about that. What's so beneficial and beautiful, and what's the curse?
The beneficial part of it means that we can imagine futures and for ourselves. So, for example, many people have been in this situation where should you take this job or that job? You could go into like all kinds of abstract thought, or you could imagine yourself, you know, in that environment. You get very honest with what it must feel like to be in that environment. You can empathize with other people because you can imagine what it's like to be that self. And most, you know, all these great works of art are kind of, a lot of them, especially theater and any kind of reflexive movies, film, have to do with imagining a self in a certain situation, mm-hmm. rather than just imagining an environment, because that self changes and responds and stuff.
Yeah.
The difficulty is that we can live in that simulated self environment and take it as real, which means that part of you that then lives in the real will suffer because there's an incongruence. So, you know, any kind of, and then it's capturable, right? So advertising gets you to imagine something, and then you live in that kind of simulation.
Okay, so we have like ground sentience, just a body moving for the environment and then responding to the realities of that environment. We have then this sort of cognition, which is a body that is in some way aware of the environment around it and can begin to problem solve in that environment, even if it's as simple as, oh, there's something up in that tree I want to get.
It's pure curiosity. Nothing is moving it toward it or moving it out of where it's standing, but it's going to move into open possibility. It's actually more driven or guided by moving into open possibility. You know, curiosity killed the cat. Why didn't the cat just sit on the couch and get fed all the time? So
yeah, nice. And then we have this kind of simulating the environment that lots of animals can actually do.
Right.
Even animals that some of us might not have realized are quite so smart. I'm putting that in air quotes for some reason, but like,
yeah,
there's a kind of intelligence there that I think often feels human only, but you're saying, no, actually that's quite present in many, many, many bodies. And then there is this next layer up, this kind of imaginal, now I can imagine myself in possibilities. Some of them, they may be real, like a job that I just got offered. I can start to imagine that, but some of them could be pure fantasy, and that can both produce incredible works of art and also quite a lot of suffering.
Yeah. And then to take it down a notch, we imagine that ourself is our ego, that's all neurotic and stuff like that. And so instead of taking care of the sum total of my human condition, I'm driven by taking care of that, which is just a simulation. Yeah.
So there's some wonderful and answer to the question, what are we? You're saying we're like, what's an analogy? We're like a Russian doll. We're some sort of like scaffolded entity. There's some like, there's these layers there. Are there metaphors or images that are useful for you to describe the gestalt, the sum total of all of these different elements of what it is to be alive in this moment?
I see I mean, I use the phrase cognitive events that grow, but if you're going to start this low, then they're sentient events that grow. Like, we're part of this cosmic unfolding of larger and larger events. Is a hard, is a problematic word, but I don't know what else to use. So you can imagine not just the individual animals, but that cognitive events are growing through cosmological time. I actually start with something before sentience, which I call resonance, which is just either an amplification or interference with the environment. So it's like waves, or energy is either being amplified due to interaction with the environment or being interfered with. And then that's slightly suggestive of a positive and negative valence, except there's no one around to prefer whether you're interfered with or amplified. So, yeah.
Is the example of the woman who you invited to just feel her feet and follow her feet and the way the horse starts to respond to that, like, we could argue that there's some balance, that there's some, maybe the horse is moving because it starts to feel pleasurable or safe, or, but also there's, it's possible that that was just a kind of resonance that was starting to happen. Like, would that potentially be an example?
Exactly. It could be resonance or very slight valence in the foot itself, because the body was picking up some kind of resonance between the horse. Yeah, that's a good use of the word, you know, so that we have something. And that's, of course, she lived, obviously. The point is she was living in a simulation and had to get her way down to try to access something extremely fundamental.
Yeah. Like, there's one of my friends and mentors and my music teacher who just, he relates to himself and his spirituality very much through musical metaphors, is sort of what you describe as this kind of cosmic unfolding of quote unquote events. It's just like, it's all this, it's all sound. It's all like the Big Bang, whatever that was a sound. So it was a note, was a chord that just is ringing and ringing. And you can sort of see everything in his kind of cosmological view is an echo of that or an extension of that. But we can sort of see it with an instrument. Like, I'm not making music if I pluck an E string, but I can see if I pluck that string that the other E string, the low E string or the high E string vibrates a little bit, because they have something in common, even though one is skinny and one is fat. And there's something about, like, if we put no story on that, no moral valence on it, no plus minus on it, stuff rings with each other or clashes with each other. And then that produces new sounds and new waveforms.
You know, I read this week, it's really a great book because he's a great writer. He's a person who can write science in a narrative story. Like, you just want to hang out at the cafe with him and listen. And it's called The Ends of the World by Peter Brannon.
Nice. It's a and cool cover too.
He, I saw him speak on Nate Hagen's podcast. But he's talking about the five mass extinctions, and I'm not going to go into it. It's a fantastic book. But just think about this. I mean, I kind of knew this, but it didn't really land. So 450 million years ago, most of the animals there were like tribalites and stuff like that. 86% of the species died. Due to these extinction events have to do with carbon cycles, and sometimes it gets carbon cycles and the movement of the continents. Sometimes the continents move away and things get isolated. Sometimes they mush together and things can't get away. At one point, the continents were, instead of aligned north to south, so when the continents are aligned north to south and it gets hotter and colder, the animals can migrate. But sometimes the continents were mushed up at the equator. And so there's no, they can mitigate climate. There's all these other reasons. But so 450 million years ago, 86% of the species went extinct. And then 375 million years ago, 75% of the species went extinct. Then we had this beautiful explosion of the fabulous fishes. But the end of the Permian, 96% of all those species, plants and animals, went extinct. And then 200 million years ago, at the age of the dinosaur, the Triassic, I don't remember when the, the Triassic, that was prior to the dinosaurs, 80% of the species went extinct. And then 75 million years ago, 76% of the species went extinct. So we're talking about this wave, and you are talking about like resonance, but then all waves have troughs, right? Also. So these cancellation events, he talks about Earth's natural killing mechanisms. I mean, this, these are like, what makes life bounce back? It's just unbelievable to me that after these flourishing, wonderful, fabulous creatures and forms, and then almost all of them go extinct. And then something small and insignificant is the ancestor of everything else that comes next.
Yeah. Yeah, like whatever little furry mammal or whatever little like surviving fish that somehow flopped onto land and didn't die, like there's some that they're with us now. We wouldn't be here if not for their survival in the wake of that last big event. It's such a, like, in the realm of story, it's sort of the grandest narrative we can get in touch with. And I also notice it provokes some existential anxiety in me. Like, you know, there are many people who argue that we are contributing as a result of, maybe as a result of spending so much time in these simulated, individually simulated realms that produce a lot of pain and suffering, but also this kind of collectively created simulation that we are contributing, maybe accelerating a wave that might have come anyways in some form, but like now it feels like shit, like it's coming.
Yeah, so that's, he has an interesting take, and what he suggests is this interesting view that in one perspective we are repeating, you know, volcanoes take fossil fuel out of the ground and burn it and cause climate disaster. He says, so from a certain perspective, we are part of this killing mechanism. But he said, from another perspective, there's something extremely beautiful from these deep time geological perspective. It's not the only perspective out there, but I'm just telling his. He says, if we burn these fossil fuels too fast, it'll be a major extinction, maybe worse than ever before, because of the speed in which it's happening. So these epochs happened over hundreds of millions of years. But he said, but what he said, but without human, without us burning so much fossil fuel, we are able to have a store of fossil fuels that can get us through the next ice age because it's coming. We're actually on the verge, naturally climatic, because something about the angle of the Earth, we're on the verge of going into another ice age. And he said, so if we can manage to keep those fossil fuels in the ground, they will be useful when we are having trouble from this natural cycle. And I think it's beautiful because he's basically saying, if we understand the Earth's forces and the Earth's genealogy and the Earth's as a living system, we can find it all, she, or it also provides these mechanisms that we can work with and kind of work the Earth and us work together, you know? And I don't want to say tame the earth, because I don't mean taming the earth, but
there's some kind of participation that becomes possible.
Exactly.
If we're mindful of avoiding ecological overshoot and are aware of the other forces that are well beyond our control, but nevertheless, like, we can relate to this possibility that there's a pretty big shift. Just, I mean, other, our own human ancestors have survived ice ages, and so there's some participation we could play in that.
Exactly.
If we're willing to get a little more real, get a little less simulated and a little more real about, like, what's actually going on? What can we see in this environment? What can we feel in this environment? And what choices can we make that are in response to, in relationship to the actual world, to actual reality, not just the simulation that we might be in?
Yeah, you know, I just thought something, I hadn't thought of it before while you were saying that, was is that we're actually kind of, it's kind of weird, because in this simulated environment, most of us are acting as, we just positively and negatively valencing experience. We're being bopped around by social media. So in a sense, do you see what I'm saying?
There's a sort of like, there's a like meta sentience in the simulated environment where a lot of us are just, ooh, I don't like that. Ooh, that pisses me off. Ooh, I want more of that. Like, kind of.
It's like, the lower skills have been hacked by the simulation.
You're putting lower in air quotes just
exactly.
For those who can't see you. Yeah,
the prior, right? Because they're more
prior.
Foundational.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And in a sense, we've lost the ability to do the next thing up, which is to walk into the possible, right? What is possible? Why do we just keep doing what we're doing and move away from what we don't like and move? What is a predicated environment, you know? And that's what he said, that this kind of thing is possible. That's interesting that maybe the same sequence has to go into
there's something fractal about it. There's this back to my friend's music kind of relation, which it's not an analogy, and it feels true to me. Like, when you play certain chords, there are other notes that emerge, overtones and undertones that you're not playing, but they are emerging out of the relationship between the notes that you are playing. And you could build a whole musicology around these ghost notes, that these tones that emerge, and in a way, like, we've done that, which can be incredibly beautiful. You know, back to your point about great works of art and the best of civilization, although a lot of the best comes with some pretty horrific worst. But, like, the risk then is that those of us who just are born into this moment think that this is it. This is reality. We're ensnared in it. And so then back to our kind of like prior foundational way of relating to reality, we're just getting buffeted around and don't have access to some of the agency that might become possible if we could kind of click into these different intelligences we all have.
Yeah. And of course, it's complicated, because at the level of sentience, the first level of sentience, the environment was your teacher, the natural environment. And at this level, it's like for-profit corporations. You're bouncing in this kind of distortion.
So at the risk of, because we've already kind of danced into this space, but there's a voice in me going like, well, first of all, thank you for just picking up my one question, what are we, and really running with it. And like, there's a part of me that just wants to receive how beautifully and awesomely and unpredictably complex we are and existence is. And just like maybe if we all had a bit more access to, like, wow, this is really what it is. Wow. Period. That would be pretty special. So thank you for like playing with that. And then there's another voice in me going like, okay, so what do we do with this? Like, all right, how do we help more people move up and down into their animal nature, back up into their imaginal space? have more freedom and agency, not get so ensnared by, you know, like I wonder if you have a point of view on if the author who wrote that book about, you know, the great die-offs has a point of view about what could be possible. What's as someone who's been studying metaphysics and human nature and reality, like what possibilities are here for us as a species that we maybe haven't accessed yet because we're so ensnared in this these simulations?
Yeah, so it's a good question. And for a long time, I didn't have an answer that seemed like it had a lot of possibility in it. Because for me, it's always been the answer's always been go back to nature, learn how to ask different questions, learn how to learn from nature with not these human eyes. This more, you know, I'm a Taoist and I did a lot of Qigong. And the reason why that was not a very hopeful answer is because so many people live in the cities, and it took me 30, 40 years living and working on biodynamic farms and in landscape at architecture and working with horses. It takes a long time to embed yourself in that kind of contact. And it's not reasonable to think you're going to save a lot of people by having them have those experiences. So in my school, the question we are pursuing is there a way for a human being to be with other human beings that affects them in the same way that nature does? Because people are going to be around other people their whole lives. So people are embedded in culture. So what kind of culture? We call it lyric culture for not a whole lot of good reasons, but what kind of culture can present itself such that the human being is confronted with what someone who goes in and learns from nature or retreats in nature or lives in a cave surrounded by nature, such that there's more people in circulation that people can have those kinds of experiences with? And that to me is a fascinating question.
I have a couple questions coming up. Maybe one is there a moment, a human to human moment, in the same way that you've shared some of these human to horse moments, where you've seen that play out? Like where you've seen what's possible when someone who's circulated through these deep embedded animal naturalistic experiences comes into contact with a person who hasn't, and what might be possible there. Any stories or examples come to mind?
Well, I think a lot of the stories we hear from the Eastern traditions around transmission, there's a lot of phrases around that, you know, the sage has become nature. You know, the sage has become nature. I think most of those, many of those stories are not that, but I think there are some true instances of that. I think that probably yourself, when you ha work with clients, are accessing something like that. You're not, it's a kind of co-presencing that I was talking to someone the other day, and they said, "Well, what should we do?" And I said, "Watch each other grow." Instead of like trying to fit, you know, there's something about, and so I think it's already there, but we haven't consciously said, and you know, put it in that question: what is it about? When you go out and you have this experience, And can I gesture? Can I use my body that way? And just to maybe wrap up, I mean, one of the ways we're working with it this year is we're looking at the different ways in which humans have communicated. And this also follows that metaphysics in a way. And the first is, you know, that first, my experience is I feel, and you know, I physically can touch you and feel whether you feel strong or debilitated, or I can touch your heart and I can feel whether your heart is racing. So this is a way we can communicate. And then later on, if you're talking about evolutionary, then we would sign. So instead of me actually touching you, you know, I would, you know, how dogs get all happy and you know that they're happy. You don't have to. So this create signing, gesturing is touching at a distance. And then a little later on, then we become oral. And the signs, these gestures are accompanied by a song. I just say a song. So instead of me having, if we're males and we're fighting over the same female, I don't have to touch you. I don't have to punch you. I can gesture that I'm going to punch you. And then later on, when I see you around the corner, I can yell at you. So we're able to have this experience at further and further distance. And then we get to the big mythic and narrative cultures where we say, now I say this whole thing, and we get very narrative storytelling. And then we get into the Homeric traditions where the saying becomes a telling. So when you have things like the big epics, they're telling you more than they're saying. Saying is like, I say this, you say that, someone says something else, but then now we're starting to get much more directed. And so I tell you something. And that's in the pre-Socratics. And then you get down to once Plato comes along and we're naming things. Like, this is courage, this is virtue. We abstract it from the story. And so then we say, well, what can we do differently? And this was your question. And what we're working with is, can we disclose ourselves as, and it comes right back to your question. I don't know who I am. I don't know who we are. I don't know what humans are, but can I get, so I'm so naked in front of you that something of that answer is disclosed to you. And that's what the horses are doing if they're not psychotic, or the trees are doing. They're just, nature just discloses. It's just there.
It's there. Beautiful. Yeah. I have two kind of responses. The first is that, and maybe I'll preface this by saying, like, at the risk of sounding like self-congratulatory, like that's when it's so annoying when someone does that. So like, if you don't want to hear me even sound potentially self-congratulatory, like pause now and skip ahead to about 2 minutes from now.
But I want to say, I'm going to enjoy it.
Yeah, great. This is at least for you and I, but an innovation I brought to my coaching practice during the pandemic, which was sourced from in me a deep place of need, that I have found for almost everyone I work with, although they often are resistant at first, is that I do all of my coaching over the telephone. What? You're going to use a telephone? Why would you use a telephone? We have video. I say, yeah, well, you sit in or stand in front of that one spot, maybe all day, and you do a lot of other things in that spot aside from getting connected to yourself and your aspirations. And so I want to just invite you to go somewhere else where you don't have to pay any attention to how I might be perceiving how you look, or, you know, your background or any of that. Like, that's part of the way I frame it to them. But before I got to that framing, it was just like, I'm a better coach when I'm out walking in the woods. And when I'm walking in the woods, I am simultaneously, I think I had this, this is the dot I wanted to connect to your framework. I'm simultaneously more in my body and more in reality. Like, I could be listening to you and just looking at the sunlight as it plays across the tree, the surface of a tree, or hearing the wind or the sound of a bird. But I also am carrying you. I have a, if you were my client, I'd have a Bonnie in my sort of head and heart. And I've noticed sometimes, like I'll ask, and this is just getting me excited, like I want to play with this even more consciously. I can ask someone, like, you know, it sounds like you're upset about that. Where do you feel the upset in your body? And before they answer, I'll feel sensation around my heart or my gut or in my shoulders. And they'll go a second later, I feel really tense in my shoulders. Like, yeah. So there's some, like, there's
That's
something happening there. Like, there's the Bonnie in my head, but there's the Bonnie I'm actually talking to. And there's
yeah.
some resonance that's occurring across a pretty, you know, you know, you're in Connecticut, I'm in Massachusetts, you could be in California, you could be in Europe, and somehow still this happens. And so I
Yeah.
just want to, like, really co-sign on, like, there's power in inviting our imaginal work to happen rooted as we're more rooted in our
Yeah.
realities.
Yeah. So, I mean, we could talk forever because that's one of the benefits of having a simulated self. Basically, you take yourself, you put it aside, because most people, you know, it's a talent, it's an art that you have. And that is when we practice group work, one of the things we notice is when someone says something, you notice the resistance. Like, I'm comfortable with the crazy things and the way my thought patterns happen. And when I'm in dialogue in like we space practice or something, and someone's starting to say something, I can feel resistance. And what we say is, no, pretend your mind is saying that. And you might say, wow, that's weird. I wonder why my mind is saying that. And so what you're describing is the ability to, like you just said, I have Bonnie in my head. I'm not saying simulation is bad, like we live in a simulation. This is a powerful thing about it. And then you can feel, you use your body as the instrument that understands what it's like to have those sounds, that song, right? The sing and the feel. You don't have the sign, you're not on video. But these lower capacities, again, air quotes, these more fundamental capacities, not only have we lost them, but they are potentially more powerful than we've ever really had them with for.
That feels like a really, in a way, that was my second response, was first just sharing that. And secondly, this sense of, you know, whatever I'm experiencing, whatever might be working or not working in my professional life and all this stuff I just described, it just feels true to me that there have been moments, they almost feel like moments of grace. And I hear this from lots of people where they suddenly get access to a feeling or an insight or an energy or a possibility that absolutely did not come from this kind of beautiful simulation machine
Right.
that we've been talking about. Like, that simulation machine can then take whatever that more foundational experience of, like, release or catharsis or joy or deep sadness, or just, I gotta move my body and climb and jump, like, whatever this life force that just is available. It's
Right.
only available when the sort of narrative and the ego and the stuff relaxes a bit. And then it's really cool when that imaginal machine can kind of come back in and work with it
Right.
and play with it. Like, there's a dialogue between the two, but the prior has to happen first. So there's some sort
Yes.
of sequencing that there
Yeah.
that feels really important. Otherwise, you're just
Exactly.
playing with ideas.
Exactly. And one of the hallmarks is that the excited body part that you were describing makes you feel more alive and continuously gives you more energy. And the other is the energy drain. So that's one of the signatures of life. You get energy for free when you're congruent and integrated with your body. And when you're, working too much in your prefrontal cortex and all these simulations, if they're not flowing from the body, they quickly exhaust themselves, you know. So.
Bonnie, you described the author of that book as someone you want to hang out in a cafe with, and I feel like this sort of, I'm so glad you said yes to this invite because you're someone I'd love to hang out more in a cafe with. Thank you for, I want to give you the last word in a moment, but I just want to say thank you for jamming with me, for saying yes to this invitation to be together in conversation without an agenda. And I've learned so much today and also from your writing and your talks, and we'll make sure to link to all of your work in the show notes. But I wonder before I give you the last word, like if anyone in this moment is going like, I want to learn more about this work with the horses or with Bonnie's work in metaphysics, where should they go to get
You
connected
should
to that?
just go to my Substack. You could put in Bonita Roy at Substack or dot Substack, or you could look up the pop-up school at Substack. It's called the
Great.
pop-up school.
Great. Okay, so I'll give you the last word. What are you
Yeah.
sitting with or leaving with, or what do you want to say to kind of complete this conversation today?
Yeah, so I just want to frame it because, I put the metaphysics together and these cool little models, but the purpose is I work in reverse. And what I really loved about our conversation is that, like, the things you're doing that work as a consultant, as a father, are intuitively moving in these deeper directions, intuitively integrating what we've lost. And so the point I want to make is that it's already latent in everyone to have more feeling, more singing, less naming and telling. And it's not like, okay, we have to learn this over. These are skill sets. I'm used to skiing and now I have to learn how to skate or something like that. These are what makes us human, because the human is this whole stack. And I just want to reflect back to you that how great it is that people are intuitively moving in these directions, and hopefully some of the kinds of things I do gives people confidence that their intuitions are right, and also gives them a little more structure in pursuing, like, what all kinds of cool things you can think about in your po coaching practice that are more in this direction.
Thanks, Bonnie. What a treat. Thanks, everyone, for listening in. I hope that we get to connect again. And regardless, I'm excited to share this with our communities.
I'm looking forward to what people might get from it.
Thanks for tuning into the Wonder Dome. This podcast was produced by me, Andy Cahill, with support from Kaylee Serqua, and post-production by Jim Serqua of Sump Pump Studios. The Wonder Dome is recorded and produced primarily on unceded Nipmuc territory. I honor their ongoing leadership and stewardship of the land. I trace my own ancestral roots to Celtic peoples from Ireland and Scotland, and to Anglo and Germanic tribes across northwestern Europe. We all come from somewhere, we're all going somewhere. May the wisdom of our ancestors guide us, and may we find our own wisdom along the way. The theme song was written and performed by Todd Marston. You can find the Wonder Dome wherever pods are casted. If you dig what we're doing here, please share widely, subscribe, and give us some love on the review boards. If you feel called to support this humble offering while making an even greater impact in the lives of others, consider becoming a monthly supporter. You can find out more at my website, thewonderdomepodcast.com. Until then, I'm wishing you a life of purpose, power, and presence. We need you now. More than ever.